ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
As this transition unfolds and we rely more and more on electricity rather than gas or oil, the network will need to be upgraded, and that all needs to be paid for by us.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find us on ABC Listen.
Another week, another historic poll for One Nation. The Marna Party has surged ahead of Labor and News poll as the Prime Minister acknowledges that many people feel the system isn't working for them. Anthony Albanese has presented a vision of optimism over grievance, saying if governments don't respond to the circumstances, populism will continue to rise. But with a growing platform comes increasing scrutiny, as One Nation learned after a series of, quote, train wreck interviews late last week. Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis.
And I'm Tom Crowley.
And Tom, the Prime Minister has stood up for a press conference. This all comes as he was announcing a state funeral for world-renowned cancer researcher and former Australian of the Year, Professor Richard Scollier. Obviously, it's very, very sad news that Richard Scollier has died. And given the work he's been doing for so long, it is kind of a heartbreaking story. Anthony Albanese said Australia has lost one of our brightest lights and one of our biggest hearts. That's a sentiment shared by many. But this came, this sad news, as he was quickly moved on to lots of questions about this pretty historic news poll. Now, we've already seen that Redbridge poll last week, which showed One Nation ahead of Labor, so they did it first. And now news poll shows that the same thing has happened. Just give me some analysis on why this is, or if this is, I should ask the if, really, historical and significant.
Yes, I mean, so the thing that people will be probably screaming at their phones, headphones already is, you know, the only poll that matters is the one on election day. So we take that as given. But I think that, I mean, I am a believer that polls tell us important things. I think we should take them with all the right grains of salt. But I suppose as a numerical quantitative person, you know, we fire off all sorts of hot takes that aren't based in polling 1,000 people. So even if you think that a sample size of 1,000 doesn't tell you everything about a country of 20-something million, this consistent a result that's come from, you know, a party that was in low single digits all the way up now to 31 in both Redbridge and News Poll, franked, if you like, at the South Australian election and in the Farrah by election in the form of actually winning seats. I think now, yes, we absolutely have to take this seriously as One Nation being the third contender for winning a large swathe of seats and competitive. You know, you would have to imagine with a primary vote of 31 that you are competitive at least in dozens of seats, if I can put it that way, and that the question of Prime Minister Pauline Hanson is not something that is just some idle curiosity or that's getting too far ahead, but now something that, you know, we need to start to ask questions of One Nation and treat them like not so much a minor party like the Greens, which might be having balance of power policies and where the questions you ask might be about how would you work with Party X or Party Y, but treating them seriously as a contender for a major party and a potential party of government. It means that the coalition, you know, is a long, long, long way back, all the way down to 18 now, which those are Susan Lee numbers. So Angus Taylor in a few months has not been able to make any headway. The position is absolutely terrible for them. But now Labor as well. It's not utterly shocking that a government in conditions that are a bit sort of tense and difficult and a second-term government that's just done something pretty risky and unpopular with some people would lose a little bit of shine compared to where it was at the election. A primary vote of close to 35 at the election, now polling at closer to 30 or the high 20s. But the fact that it's going to One Nation and not to the coalition is, you know, I think there's no reason to doubt that it is real, and it just creates a whole different set of questions that Anthony Albanese has to answer than what it would if the flow was going to the coalition.
Yeah, the Prime Minister, of course, was asked about this, and he wouldn't be drawn on whether he'd prefer to go up against Angus Taylor or Pauline Hanson as opposition leader. But he keeps saying, they keep telling us, it's their talking points clearly, that they understand people's frustrations, the economy isn't working for people. So these are all the messages when they do focus groups that they're getting loud and clear. So they're doing that classic political thing where you repeat the same message, like, we hear you kind of thing. Yeah. We know the economy isn't working for you. What I think is a problem, though, for Labor is that the solution they've come up with in the form of the budget, is clearly not resonating with people as a solution to the economy is not working for you. So just late last week, we had the Prime Minister tell us that this budget was crafted very much to deal with the rise in populism and the sense that the economy isn't working for you. And yet so far, and I'm not arguing that's forever, but so far, people aren't seeing the budget as a game changer on the economy isn't working for you. Something is going wrong in that process. So they may want to be doing all this dramatic stuff to try and send this message, but that message is not being received, Tom.
Yeah, and I mean, like, it isn't a game changer, right? And I think that that's – and it actually was deliberately constructed not to be a game changer. And this is where I think the government and the opposition to an extent in the way that they've shifted in their policy offering – they're learning the right lessons, but I think they're learning them a little bit too slowly, and they're going to need to kind of keep going further down this path. I think it absolutely is all about results and whether you can actually prove that you from government can make people's lives better, or from opposition that you have a credible plan that will actually make people tangibly feel better about their position in life. And I think both parties have done the first step out of the gate, which is, all right, we need to go back to our own too hard basket and to the things that seemed too risky before, but that we thought were good ideas, capital gains and negative gearing, bracket creep. But even those, as you say, I think people are sort of so fed up with the status quo, so fed up with, you know, really 15 years or so in which, in a material sense, the median income earner hasn't gone forward that much on their living standards, that these kind of things don't really touch the sides. And a capital gains and negative gearing policy that was designed with grandfathering and all the rest to have a contained effect on the housing market. The whole point was that it wasn't going to turn the whole thing into negative territory, that it would shave 2 percentage points of growth off, create 75,000 new homeowners over a decade. That number could have been bigger had the policy been more radical. It would have been more contentious as well. But I think that both parties are, I suppose, realizing that if you want to be the ones that are, you know, the adults in the room and saying that the establishment and the system as it is going to deliver tangible change for you, well, you're going to have to go probably a little bit harder than your instincts would tell you.
So this comes as Labor is trying to kind of manage the story here. Tanya Plibersek telling Sunrise, we get the message, which is we need big changes, which Labor is delivering. She's saying, you know, that whole we get the message is the message that Labor wants to send. You've got the union movement, ACTU, Sally McManus highlighting Hanson is opposed to the minimum wage increase. She just is trying to hammer home the message that Pauline Hanson is not in favour of the little guy, right? They're trying to build a story, which is that One Nation is not in favour of the battler, even though they are very much being backed by battlers. And now, if they can land that, it's potent. We know the other person who's trying to land that, all for their own political reasons, by the way, is Andrew Hastie, who is, you know, kind of a very different kind of right-winger inside of the Liberal Party, but he's going full throttle trying to take on One Nation, saying, you know, they're MAGA first, they're not Australia first. And that's been his message for a while, trying to make people make the connection between Hanson and Trump and the big end of town and get out of the sort of thinking that they are there for ordinary people. At this stage, though, I'm not sure anyone has landed that, and we're somehow getting close at least to some scrutiny for One Nation, which I think is important. Last week it was very clear that everyone was giving it a red-hot go, trying to scrutinise this party that is now saying it wants to be a party of government, that the polling is saying may be a party of government, which makes it obviously need to be accountable to its policy platforms and how it would deliver them. One Nation had some pretty significant gaffes last week. Just walk me through what happened and why it's so significant and whether you really think it's going to resonate, because that bit I reckon we should have a red hot debate about. I'm not sure, but it was definitely a gaffe by Barnaby Joyce on whether permanent residents will have to sell their homes, and then they had to walk it back. It was messy. It was ugly. It was the end of the week, and it showed, I thought, some real vulnerabilities for One Nation.
Yes, well, I think so. One Nation's, just to sort of step through the story, I mean, very briefly, One Nation's Sean Bell also seemed to get the details confused here about exactly what the policy meant. Then it was Barnaby Joyce on Andrew Bolt's program who said it one way, said, yes, we will, you know, just become a citizen. Yes, you will have to sell your homes. And then within the space of the same program, called the producers of Bolt's program back and said, oh, actually, can you get me on again? I've got to change my mind on that. I got it wrong. Oh, the policy's this. And it did create that sense of policy on the run. It would have been an utter disaster for the leader of the Liberal Party or the Labor Party, or had front benchers been so confused about what their policy was. But maybe I'm going where you're going on this, PK. I just don't. I think that stuff's baked in. I don't think that is why people are turning to One Nation, because they believe that they'll have, eloquent and nicely written PBO-costed policies that will rival those of Labor and the Liberals. It's very much that outsider impulse. I'm not certain how much this hurt them.
Yeah, that's my view. However, if they weren't sure, well, Barnaby Joyce wasn't, if 400,000 Australians, because remember, permanent residents are absolutely Australians, would be able to keep their homes or not. That is a very, very, very fruitful scare campaign, my friend. I mean, that is a lot of people with a lot of homes and a lot of material to create that can create a lot of unease. So I don't think it'll become an issue of, ooh, did they get that costed right? Ooh, like sort of wonky. But
no, you're right.
That's a lot of people.
It's a lot of people. And I think that permanent residence dimension in particular, I think that was a trap that Angus Taylor and co. walked into with their budget reply. I think not realising how many families have long-time permanent residents living alongside citizens who would be very upset and would vote accordingly. And this is a point that Cosmaris has been making a lot and that others have been making, that there are, you know, entire seats where there are lots of people who will be really upset by going after permanent residents. And so there's an element of damage there that now I think One Nation has clearly given themselves, I guess slipped on the same banana peel and will have the same struggles with that particular group of voters as a result. But more broadly, yeah, I mean, I think you're right that the last week has seen both major parties playing the man a lot more with One Nation and trying to do that scrutiny job. Obviously to some extent it can work, but I just come back to, I don't think that you can defeat One Nation, and I think this is the message of the kind of right-wing populist insurgents around the world, with just the negative and just going on the attack. And, you know, I think the Gina Rinehart plane thing, you know, how often have we seen that with Trump and Farage, that people just simply don't care about where the money's coming from or the sorts of people you're associating with. If they view these politicians as the outsiders who say what they want them to say and who kind of say what we're all thinking, etc., that stuff just kind of washes off like water off a duck's back. I can see why Andrew Hastie's going down the Trump MAGA direction. I don't think any of that stuff on its own is enough to dissuade people from voting for Pauline Hanson, unless you can do the other half of the equation, which is, why are you any better? Because that's essentially all, I think, in the minds of so many people who are now telling pollsters that they intend to vote One Nation. If you say to them, oh, but, you know, Pauline Hanson, is she up for the job? Does she have the right policies? Could she manage the economy? I think that voter says, well, maybe not, and I don't think Pauline's perfect, but I'm sick of the other lot and I'm sick of those two parties and they can't do it either. And so, again, unless you can, and Anthony Albanese clearly grasps this, that line that he used today, the Bill Clinton line, it's the economy, stupid. They understand that it's the economic conditions that have to turn and it's people that have to actually feel that they're in a better position financially in their lives that will be the be-all and end-all of whether they can get re-elected. But you can't necessarily guarantee that in an uncertain world if we're heading for, you know, kind of inflation and perhaps even a recession pressure at the same time. The government could do all the right things and people could still not feel actually much better financially by the time of the next election. So just because you realise that it's the economy, stupid, doesn't solve all your problems.
That's right. Look, there's some breaking news as we record too. We're recording on a Monday. It's a public holiday for many of you, so hopefully it will be in your ears as you go for a nice walk if you do get this public holiday. Clearly we don't, but we're okay. We like it. We like working. But there is some disturbing news, I think. Israel has conducted strikes against military targets in western and central Iran. That's hours after Iran fired a salvo of missiles at Israeli targets in retaliation for an attack on Beirut's southern suburbs. Now, these strikes come despite these reports we've seen that the US President Donald Trump has told the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu not to retaliate and risk raising the possibility of reigniting a full-scale war with Iran. So watch this space. This is a fascinating story. Clearly orchestrated leaks for you to know that Donald Trump has allegedly stood up to Benjamin Netanyahu and told him, you watch it, we don't want this to escalate, we want to deal with Iran, so he wants out, right? But Netanyahu still retaliates, and now we don't know what will happen next. We're recording this, as I say, in sort of middle of the day on Monday, but that is an escalation, that there's been a retaliation, and makes it very difficult, I think, for the US. And I suspect, you know, I think we'll hear more from Trump in relation to Benjamin Netanyahu. He's obviously getting annoyed because this is now becoming a problem politically for him, that this is enduring. So I don't know what your thoughts are, Tom, but this is a war, taking it always back to the domestic, or a domestic Australian politics podcast, that has gone on way longer than we needed and wanted it to for our economy. And it's really getting baked in, isn't it?
Yeah. And we are approaching the point where the economic consequences will start to get materially worse, I think. You know, it's always been this uncertainty about when would the war end. Getting into this kind of forever war territory and having the Strait of Hormuz continue to be shut. Jenny Wilkinson, the Treasury Secretary at Estimates last week, and Michelle Bullock, they appeared within hours of one another before set at Estimates. And both of them were pretty clear that the latest inflation data is already starting to show the signs of the oil price shock spilling over into other things like building materials, freight and logistics. The next round then is things like the things that are freighted and, you know, got to you on trucks, like groceries. You know, the price of those sorts of things start to go up as well. The price of construction itself starts to go up. And it's that sort of seeping into the broader economy that the RBA in particular, I think Michelle Bullock continues to sound very, very worried about the second order effects of this shock feeding into broader inflation pressures here at home. And I think the comments that she made last week, certainly, you know, despite the fact that there's some nervousness in the housing market and all the rest of it, didn't give the impression of someone who thought conclusively that the job of tightening was necessarily done. And the RBA is a lot more worried about inflation than it is about economic output. But the economic output part of it is there as well. We do have a housing market that's a little soft. Household consumption, you know, pretty middling in the last quarter of data that we got last week. And so the longer this war goes on, Jenny Wilkinson saying that Japan and China and maybe South Korea are in a reasonable position with their fiscal buffers and stockpiles of fuel, but some of those other Southeast Asian countries are not. And the risk that they start imposing controls on fuel and then things get a whole lot worse for us. There are these kind of, you know, cascading events that sit down the line, the kinds of reasons that we've been going around, or our leaders have been going around Southeast Asia, sort of trying to shore up these relationships. We haven't really got to the crunch point where one of those gets tested yet, but the longer this war goes on, the greater that risk is. And so we're not talking about it day to day as much at the moment, but it hasn't gone away.
No. And of course, there are the political implications. If you want to sort of sell the link between MAGA and One Nation, then the longer this war goes on, the kind of more potential you have to make that stick, which is why you're seeing people like Andrew Hastie lock into this framing. And the thing about framing in politics is you need to repeat it a lot till people get it in their heads, until they see Hanson as synonymous with Trump. That's what these people are trying to achieve. I know I've spoken to lots of them. What are they trying to do? They want you to think of Hanson and Trump, and as the same. And the reason they want that is they know, all the polling's telling us, that people, they might be into Hanson, they might be into populism in Australia, they're not into Trump.
Yeah.
It's, you know, they're not into what Trump's doing with this war and the economic ramifications. They don't blame the government entirely for all of the economic problems coming from the Iran war. And so if you can link the two, they hope to dismantle some of the support for Hanson. And I can see the logic behind it. I'm not saying it's working yet, but I can see it.
Yeah. So then question for you, PK. If a recession comes or some other signal, perhaps, you know, kind of further rate hikes. I mean, I think it's quite possible the RBA, if it were to hike a couple more times, that you would then get a recession as a result. Is that better for One Nation or is it worse? From where they are now, does a recession in discrediting the government and its economic management, does it help the insurgent? Or does, you know, do difficult economic times make people look twice at One Nation and think more about whether they are ready to manage the economy? What do you reckon?
It's yet to be really tested. I think, though, when you do find that, you know, there's a national security issue or a lot of uncertainty, people do lock in behind things they feel like they can trust, historically speaking. However, you know, if people are to blame Trump, I mean, I think they'll blame the local government too, by the way, by then. I don't think Trump will be the only one blamed for a recession here. That's fanciful for Labor, fanciful. But if they are to blame Trump a little bit, then hammering home that Hanson has been the one standing up for Trump is, I think, politically useful. I think it's the only thing they've got, to be honest. I can't see what else they've got.
Yeah, I agree. And I think a recession potentially does open the door a little bit for the coalition as well. I mean, if there was one bright spot in the Redbridge poll last week, it was for the coalition, it was that on economic management, they still had a really comfortable lead over both Labor and One Nation. That was the only issue on that long list of things that the coalition came out ahead on. And I do wonder whether, you know, a really, really severe economic circumstance in the next year or two, clearly not good for the government, but whether that gives Angus Taylor and the Liberals an opportunity to sort of say, look, we're the ones you would rather turn to now rather than the unknown One Nation, because you know us, we're the Liberal Party, I'm Angus Taylor, I've been around a while, whether that is the one opening for them. And I think the interesting test case there will be Victoria, where economic issues are a lot more salient, public anger about debt, it's much more of an election. There are other things going on in Victoria as well, but much more of an election where debt and the economy will be centre stage. Does that allow Jess Wilson and her Liberals to see off One Nation by focusing on the economy and being the more credible alternative economic manager? Because if it does work in Victoria and if Jess Wilson becomes the Premier, I think that might bode pretty well for Angus Taylor. But if the Liberals can't get any purchase on an economic narrative in Victoria, conversely, and One Nation just kind of bulldozes all the way through and makes significant inroads there, well, then maybe that's not such good news for him.
Mm. At the same time, we've had this story that everyone's denounced. Well, not everyone, actually, because I'll mention who hasn't, but many have denounced, which is a billboard in Melbourne's CBD featuring a picture of the Victorian Labor Premier Jacinda Allen with the slogan, "Ditch the Witch." It's been condemned by a lot of people. Of course, one of the key people here is Julia Gillard, who was, of course, our first and, worth saying, only woman Prime Minister who faced the same kind of language and campaigning. And she's put out a statement too saying she was disgusted to see the phrase used again after being subjected to it 15 years ago. Pauline Hanson told Sky, "Suck it up, sweetheart." Victoria, as you mentioned, going to the polls, do we just suck it up? Well, no, you don't have to like Jacinda Allen. I mean, I know people are red hot with rage and can't wait to vote this Victorian government out. Like, that's cool. Go crazy. But obviously this imagery of her being sort of a witch, which is one of the most sexist, misogynistic tropes in our culture, is gross. Like, just maybe vote her out because you don't, like, agree with their policies and you don't think they've done a good job. Anyway, really strange. But obviously there is politics to be extracted here. Like, not everyone is outraged by this. I think Pauline Hanson saying "suck it up, sweetheart" probably has a base of support. I think there's a lot of people who'd think it's fine. I don't think we're all united on thinking it's sexist and misogynistic, truthfully. I believe that there is objective evidence for how it's misogynistic language. I really do. I think it's steeped in history and you can prove it. But that doesn't mean everyone has one voice in terms of how they see this stuff, which is why we're seeing a political division.
Yeah, I mean, I think the word witch is about as clear-cut as it could possibly get on that front, PK. I agree with you. Oh, yeah, the harking back to Julia Gillard, it just made me reflect this morning. Are we in a better place as far as public discourse, what is it, 15 years on, or a worse one than we were back then? I mean, in some senses, I think, you know, you would probably say that women are more visible in leadership now than they were in Julia Gillard's time, and of course her parting hope that things would get easier subsequently for women in leadership. But I think the tone of politics and the kind of what I would call the kind of the gleeful nastiness that I think has become part of, you know, started with Donald Trump. It has always been such an important part of the way that he approaches politics. And one of the things about the people who like Donald Trump, they really enjoy, they go to rallies and they cheer when he says things that are deliberately provocative and personal. And he does it with all sorts of, you know, Ron DeSantis became Meatball Ron. You know, there are gendered ones. There are all sorts of just different insult politics. That has changed the tone of how people who are attracted to this sort of outsider, forget the whole system, burn the whole thing down kind of politics, don't necessarily mind when that takes the form of nastiness directed at the incumbents. So I think you're right in that sense.
Yeah, I just think it's a statement of the bleeding obvious that there is a part of the community that doesn't find it offensive, that thinks it's absolutely fair game. And that's, you know, what we're grappling with. There is a difference of view on that. I think it is, like, undeniably sexist. And the thing is, it's not just about the hurt feelings of Jacinda Allen. I want to add this. Although, you know, everyone deserves respect. Don't get me wrong. She deserves to be respected, even if you don't think she's doing a good job or want to vote her out. That's two things can be true at once. But it is, of course, the danger on the consequences on all women when you start talking about women that disrespectfully. And that is a real problem for all of us, I think. Look, Tom, before we go, I want to celebrate some good news from today. As someone who does need a lot of respect, my podcast co-host for the last 10 years, the incomparable and brilliant Fran Kelly, has been appointed as an Officer of the Order of Australia.
She has now
an AO for Distinguished Service to Broadcast Journalism and Social Justice. Of course, she spent 17 years behind the mic on Radio National Breakfast and several more decades holding politicians and key figures to account across the board. Huge congrats to Fran, who I think is, you know, really, really well-deserved recipient. Of course, there are many other recipients today, but we just thought we would shout out the one that is in our kind of, well, she's our pod person, okay?
So absolutely, that's fair enough, I think. Yeah, no, it's very hearty congratulations, Fran. And I mean, she just is one of those figures when I came to the ABC that you just think, oh my goodness, I might get to meet Fran Kelly. You know, she's just been around. I mean, I'm young enough that she's sort of, it was a fixture of my childhood watching the ABC and being a politics nerd as a teenager and a uni student, and then all the way through kind of listening to her and watching her as well. A fun little anecdote that I told on radio this morning, PK, was in my Treasury days, that there was a treasurer who I didn't name, but I don't think I am harming anyone by saying that it was Josh Frydenberg, who used to love to get officials to play him while he played Fran Kelly in briefings. And he would only feel that he'd understood an issue if he could survive the Fran Kelly interview as he played it out in his mind. And it was always Fran's pointed questions that he was most nervous about to prove that he knew his stuff. So I think that's a nice testament to Fran, the fearless interviewer. And yes, wonderful podcast co-host of yours. Congrats, Fran.
Oh, that's a great story. Okay. There you go. Josh Frydenberg, scared of Fran Kelly, the way it should be. Now, tomorrow, Mel Clark will join me for the latest developments. Of course, the public holiday will be over, so there'll be a lot of action. We'll obviously know more about the fallout from the Iran war as well. If you've got a question for us, send it to thepartyroom@abc.net.au, and Fran and I will answer it for our next Question Time edition. See you, Tom.
See ya.